Psalm 116 in the Hebrew creates another little hiccup, which brings us back to what we're used to, being one behind. So it's only when you get Psalm 114, 15 and 16 that you've got to do a little bit of special mathematics. Because in the Greek Septuagint, the Latin Vulgate and the Christian liturgical books, as we've already said, Psalm 9 and 10 became Psalm 9. So the Hebrew Psalm 114 and 15 were also Psalm 113. We've just done that. So we're two behind at this stage. In the present psalm, the process is reversed. Here, it's the Greek, Latin, and liturgical texts which divide the Hebrew Psalm 116 into 114 and 15. Pretty hard to remember all this. I couldn't remember it myself. But so it divides Psalm 116. The first half is 114 because we're now two behind. But the second half is 115, so we catch up.
You're using Hebrew numbering, are you?
Yes. Yeah, I'm using Hebrew numbering throughout.
But the Missal uses Latin.
The Missal uses, the liturgical texts use the Vulgate and the Septuagint. That's why the Missal is different from the Bibles. Because all Bibles today, well, all Bibles, as far as I know, they should anyhow, all Bibles follow the Hebrew numbering. So you'll always find a divergence once you get to Psalm 9. Now, let's get to the psalm itself. On the personal level, the psalmist is thanking God because he's escaped death. He speaks of his being abandoned and powerless to help himself. He speaks also of his interior affliction. He's taking part in a liturgy in which he's fulfilling a vow taken when ill, which was normal. He took a vow when he was ill that if he got better he'd do something, so now he's in the having offered some animal, etc. He's now thanking God and fulfilling his vow. All right. Verse 19 suggests a communal dimension. God has liberated his people from the slavery and death of exile and restored them to life in bringing them back to the temple. So a personal sickness, death, safety becomes a symbol for the nation, death, restoring safety. It's a song of love, of faith and of thanksgiving. This psalm is listed among the Hallel psalms, sung on the pilgrimage feasts. We've done this, we started it last week. Tabernacles, Passover and Pentecost, and also at Hanukkah, and each month at the new moon. They sang these particular psalms, 114 through to 118. Psalm 116 was the first psalm sung after the meal on these special occasions. And so scholars suggest when it says in Matthew 26:30 that after the Last Supper they sang a psalm and then went to the Valley of Kidron, this is most likely, because it is the Feast of Passover, it could well be Psalm 116 that they sang. You can't be certain of that. And the reason you can't be absolutely certain of it is that though the Synoptic Gospels portray the Last Supper as a Passover meal, they do that, it looks like, because it had Passover significance and it was on the occasion of the Passover. But it was not actually a Passover meal. There was no lamb there. Jesus is the lamb, eh? And also, according to John, Jesus died at middle of the afternoon on the Friday. They all have him dying on the Friday. But in John, the Friday is the day before the Passover. So that Jesus died as the Paschal lamb was being slain for the feast which happened after Jesus' death that evening. Now, if John's right, and it's likely that he is, then the synoptics haven't given us the chronological accuracy. There are other opinions on this, I know, but they don't stand up to investigation, in my view. What's happened is Jesus is dying on the Thursday, having a supper on the Thursday night. It's not yet the Passover, but he gives Passover significance to that meal. So in which case, he could have sung any psalm. Had it been a Passover meal, he would have sung Psalm 116. So that's why I'm saying we can't give absolute certainty to this, but it's probable, likely, and some thought. So let's begin. The first part of Psalm 116, which is Psalm 114 in your missals, reads, I love Yahweh. He has heard my voice and my plea. Now, this is quite important, simple but important. The word used for love in verse 1 is the Hebrew ahav. By the way, King Ahab, whose wife was Jezebel, his name means love. She called him love. The stories in the Bible don't make him sound too loving, but the stories in the Bible written by Jews. And he was the king of Israel, so you've got to be a bit wary. Who writes history is always worth asking. So, back to here. The word ahav means love, and it's rendered in the Greek, that's the Septuagint, by the verb agapen or agapao. Agape, you've heard probably the noun. Now this agapao is not a word that talks about feeling. Love in English nearly always has a bit of a connotation of loving feelings, you know. Well, agape doesn't talk about that. You might have them or you mightn't have them. The accent is on fidelity, keeping your bargain, keeping your covenant, doing what you said you'd do. That's what love is in this setting. And also in the New Testament, by the way. That's why Jesus can say, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. It's absolutely logical. You'll keep your part of the arrangement. If you don't, I don't care. If you feel loving and don't do it, well, you're not loving, are you? So, whereas if you do it, even if you're feeling dreadful, you are loving. So it's truly important, this. And there's Deuteronomy 6:5. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart. And heart includes mind in the Hebrew. Your inner being, right from the inner core, not just appearances. And with all your soul, your longing, and with all your might, all of your action, all the things you do, all your energy that you put into action. That's how you'll do this. Meaning you'll do God's will. Simple as that. Now, I hope that's clear, because it's really important, and it's right through the New Testament as well. Jesus asks Peter, do you love me? Agape. And Peter balks. He doesn't actually answer that question. He says, you know I love you, and he says, phileo, which is feeling, friendship. You know I care for you. You know you mean a lot to me, but I can't really say I love you, because I'm not sure whether I might fail again. Do you get me? I mightn't keep my part of the bargain. So that's what love means in the Bible, normally. However, it is a fact that there's one text in the Hebrew Bible, only one, this is it, which uses the word raham for love of God, love for God. And raham comes from the Hebrew rehem, which is the womb. It's the most affectionate word you can have, the love a mother has for the child in her womb. So in Psalm 18, verse 1, and nowhere else in the whole of the Hebrew Scriptures, and rightly, the prophet says, I love you, Yahweh, my strength, which means I'm head over heels in love with you. I feel really close to you. You know, all that love might connote in our common parlance of feeling. But that's the only text. The rest are all... For example, a suzerain, a king, a bully, a big man, I don't know, what do they call them? A head man in, say, Afghanistan, a tribal leader or something. Is it just a bully, really? He's running the whole area bordering on Afghanistan or something. And you're only just you, and you've got your family there, and you've got some... You're running a little town, you're another bully, but not a bigger bully. And he says, well, right... I'll look after you if there's a war, if the other tribe come up, if the, come in, then I'll be with you. But I want 50% of the opium. That's it. And if there's a war on, I'll need any boy over 18, the family, and also, I've got my eye on three or four of the girls there as my wives, that kind of thing. So you make all these bargains. Well, if the bloke you've made the bargain with hates your guts, I have to tell you, but he loves you, got it? Meaning he keeps his side of the bargain. So it's got nothing to do with feeling at all. He just keeps the covenant and the agreement. And if he says, well, you didn't love me, meant you didn't pay up. Well, that's the word agapao, so it's quite important to hold that in your mind. In other words, to console ourselves, hopefully. Love is what you do, really. And then bring it into a Christian setting. Love is keeping the commandments of Jesus, and his commandments are to love one another, meaning do good to those who hate you. Doesn't mean invite them to your party, or, you know, just feel over, just so affectionate towards them you're thinking of, you know, making a date or anything. It just means do good to them. Do what is right to them. Pray for them. Pray. It goes on to say that, doesn't it? Pray for those who do. So don't let them destroy your soul or get you to react to them unjustly because they're reacting to you unjustly. No, he was acting.
He was doing it because he was afraid not to.
That's right. So he was loving in the meaning of this word. Loving means you're using love in the sense that you mean it in. I like it. Love means he did what he had to do, whatever the motives. That's what the word means, agapao. Yeah, I'm just using the word love carefully, but I mean, that's what it means in these texts when it says, love the Lord your God. It is saying, do God's will. Now, obviously, it would be better if you did it out of beautiful motives and then you go on and on and on, and that's all called for too. But I'm only talking about the word, so that if you actually did something for an enemy out of fear, out of hatred, I don't know what, but you actually did it, the right thing by that person, though you were feeling lousy, sometimes people feel they're not very loving in the Christian sense, but they are because they've done it. And they think you should feel loving, but you mightn't be able to feel loving. Do you see what I'm trying to say, Mary? Yeah. So whatever your motives, this word, as a word, means keep your side of the bargain. And it doesn't buy into feelings or motives. That doesn't mean they're not important. Verse 2. He listens to me. So verse 1 again. I love Yahweh because he's heard my voice and my plea. And he's not saying Raham. He's saying Ahav. He listens to me when I call to him. The psalmist knows that Yahweh is drawn near so as to hear him, and he's encouraged to keep calling out in supplication. The snares of death encompassed me. This is what his situation was like. The pangs of Sheol laid hold of me. Sheol is Hades. I was overcome with distress and anguish. I called on Yahweh's name. Yahweh, I pray, save my life. Gracious is Yahweh and righteous. God is tenderly compassionate. There's the beautiful word, Rahamim. God is tenderly compassionate. And those statements about God go right back to the very core of the faith of Israel or Judah, expressed, as I've done with you often, Exodus 34:6. Yahweh passed before Moses and he said, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God tenderly compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness and faithfulness. That's God. Yahweh, verse 6, protects the naive and the immature. When I was brought low, he saved me. Return, O my soul, to your rest, for Yahweh has done bountifully with you. So, obviously he's gone through the thing and now it's in remission or whatever, and he's able to live again and he's thanking God for that. God so loved us that he gave us his Son, who gave his life to redeem us from the slavery of death, sin, and the law, the Torah, the constrictions of the law. This is transposing this, of course, to Romans chapter 8, verse 18. I'll read you from St. Paul, who says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subject to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So the whole of creation knows that it's all focused finally on human beings, which are the peak of creation. And when human beings, according to Paul, become like Jesus, the whole of creation will dance for joy. And it will. We wouldn't have any ecological problems. We wouldn't have, you know, a whole lot of degradation wouldn't be going on if we were all saints. Don't worry, it'd be quite marvellous. And that's what it's longing for, says Paul. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labour pains until now. And not only creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly while we wait for the adoption, the final adoption, namely the redemption of our bodies, that we are risen like Christ, raised into glory. So long for heaven, really, meaning communion with God in the ultimate life of the resurrection. Verse 8. He delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, and my feet from stumbling. I will walk in the sight of Yahweh, in the land of the living. Now, part two. Bit of a change of mood here. This is Psalm 116, verse 10, of course, in the Hebrew, but it moves into a different psalm in the Septuagint and the Latin and the church documents. We're now reading Psalm 115, verse 1. So it's been a bit tricky for these last, just remember 14, 15, 16, and you have to wobble them a bit. And you've got the record there anyhow. This psalm begins with, staying with the Hebrew, verse 10 of 116 reads, I believed even when I said, I am surely sorely afflicted. These words are quoted by Paul in 2 Corinthians 4:13. This is just a curious point. The first words are quoted when he says, just as we have the same spirit of faith that is in accordance with scriptures, and he reads the scripture, I believed and so I spoke. Well, you'd never know where that comes from, but I believed even when I said, in this translation. We also believe and so we speak. So he's used this text as a hanger on which to make the point about belief leading to evangelization. Back to the psalm. Verse 11, I said in my consternation, everyone is false. So, taking Psalm 116, he's still this sick man, he's reminding everyone was untrue to him, all his friends abandoned him, think of Job on the dunghill, whatever you want to do. Now this is also quoted by Paul. It sounds like we're dealing with one of his favourite psalms here. Although everyone is false, there it is, let God be proved true. It's Romans 3:4, God won't be false. We cannot rely on human help, only God is absolutely worthy of trust. Isaiah 2:22, turn away from mortal human beings who have only breath in their nostrils, for of what account are they? Jeremiah 17:5, thus says Yahweh, cursed are those who trust in mere mortal human beings and make mere flesh their strength, whose hearts turn away from God. Now Psalm verse 12 reads, what shall I return to Yahweh for all his goodness to me? I will, and here we've got a refrain, it's going to occur again later in the psalm, I will lift up the cup of salvation. That little bit will change, you'll see. That the words, the cup of salvation, aren't in the refrain later, but the rest is. I will lift up the cup of salvation and call on the name of Yahweh. I will pay my vows to Yahweh in the presence of all his people. And I was reminded of the book of Sirach, chapter 50, verse 15 and the following, which reads, and I think it's, you can see the parallels. Simon the priest held out his hand for the cup of salvation, and poured it out at the foot of the altar, a pleasing odour to the Most High, the King of all. Then the sons of Aaron shouted. They blew their trumpets of hammered metal. They sounded a mighty fanfare as a reminder before the Most High. Then all the people together quickly fell to the ground on their faces to worship their Lord the Almighty, God Most High. Then the singers praised him with their voices in sweet and full-toned melody. So he's enjoying a little bit of a ceremony here. Pour their drink offering of the blood of the grape into the ground. So here it is. I'll lift up this cup and call on Yahweh. Precious in the eyes of Yahweh is the death of his faithful ones. Faithful ones, Hasidim, you might have heard the word, are those who've welcomed God's chesed. That's why they're called Hasidim. God's chesed is God's kindness. And God's kindness is over. We've got to welcome it, or we don't receive it. It's given, but not received. So we need. And they're the ones. The faithful ones are the ones who welcome the grace and act accordingly. Keep the covenant. Psalm 31. Love Yahweh, all you his saints. Yahweh preserves the faithful. Meaning, Yahweh preserves those who welcome God's love. It's not automatic. Verse 16, and the conclusion of our psalm. Yahweh, I am your servant. I am your servant, the child of your maidservant or serving girl. You have loosed my bonds. And here's our repeat of the refrain with a slight change. Instead of cup of salvation, it's got thanksgiving sacrifice. That's all. Just a variation on a theme. I will offer to you a thanksgiving sacrifice and call on the name of Yahweh. I will pay my vows to Yahweh in the presence of all his people. And here's a few little New Testament references where you can see the language is used. It has to be transposed, of course, in your mind, but they use the language of the biblical text to find words to talk about the Last Supper, about the Mass, about the Eucharist, about what's happening. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a sharing in the blood of Christ? Just as the cup of blessing was, in the other case, was the blood of goats and animals, you know. 1 Corinthians 11, Jesus took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, my life-giving. Not the life-giving of an animal now, but mine. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. So do what I'm doing, meaning you pour out your blood for others. You know, that's what it means. So you love one another as I have loved you. You give your life to others in love the way I'm giving my life for you. And of course this becomes a ritual reenactment of it and a symbol of it and a way of living it out in a music and drama and all of that. Symbol, sacrament. The Latin for symbol, symbolon in Greek, is sacramentum. That's where we get our word sacrament from. Jesus did the same, this is Luke 22, Last Supper, with the cup after supper, saying, this cup that is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood. So as Jesus pours the wine into the cup for them to drink, he's telling them that he's pouring his life out for them in love, and he wants them to drink in that love.